Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with a tale of civic neglect and its consequences. Back in 2013, the city of San Diego decided to drain Lake Morena down to below 3% of capacity in order to pump drinking water to San Diegans during the drought, all without ever asking San Diego residents to conserve water. Residents in Lake Morena complained this would harm wildlife, tourism, and property values in Morena Village, also putting lives at risk by not leaving enough water for firefighting aircraft. In 2014, Mayor Bob Vilner put a halt to draining the lake. But after Mayor Kevin Faulkner took office, he authorized draining the lake again, ignoring residents' concerns. Now, angry residents are accusing the city of draining the lake so low that during the border fire, firefighting helicopter pilots found there wasn't enough water in Lake Morena to scoop up. So reportedly, they were forced to turn back. With nearby Lake Barrett also drained by San Diego down to just 6% of its capacity, firefighting aircraft resorted to searching for water in backyard ponds or flying all the way to Loveland Reservoir in Alpine to get water, witnesses say. In the border fire, every second counted. The fire killed two people and burned down five homes, as well as 11 outbuildings. Jim and Kyrie Keefe tried to flee the fast-burning wildfire, running into boulders behind their home since the transmission on their car had failed. 10 days later, volunteer searchers found their bodies huddled together between two boulders, dead of smoke inhalation. At a heated meeting of the Campo Lake Morena Community Planning Group earlier this month, residents vented anger and a determination to demand change. Some also voiced support for legal remedies to take back control of their local water supply. Campo resident Karen McIntyre led a discussion on exploring how residents can keep both Lake Morena and Barrett Lake at higher levels. McIntyre stated that new laws recently enacted in California mean locals can start getting control of their own water supplies. She believes local does not mean San Diego, a city that residents near Lake Morena do not live in nor have any voice in. The city of San Diego, over an hour distant from this rural fire-prone region, obtained the rights to the reservoir's water years ago through an ill-conceived agreement with the county. Lake Morena has gone from being the third largest lake in San Diego County to the smallest among all 24 lakes countywide. McIntyre railed against the city's actions. She charged, "Precious moments were lost, and that caused the fire to get out of control." The morning the border fire started, CAL FIRE officials were initially predicting it would be put out at 3 to 4 acres. Instead, it scorched over 7,000, lasting nearly a week. "The prospect of even worse fires in the summer and fall months scares the living daylights out of me," said McIntyre, who urged residents in all communities at risk to join together and fight the city. She held up photos to show beautiful lakefront views before the draining began, and then another photo taken recently. "This is what we have now, a cracked mud puddle out there," she said. She also voiced outrage that while we're in the middle of a firestorm, the city of San Diego decides they're going to loosen their restriction on water use. "That means our water," she told neighbors and community planners. Adding insult to injury, after taking water from Lake Morena and drying up the town's economy, the city of San Diego diverted that water to a reservoir in Otay. Then, after heavy rains, the Otay Reservoir became too full, so the city dumped Lake Morena's precious water supply into the ocean. Other reservoirs in the city limits are kept full and attractive, while only rural areas outside the city limits are having their reservoirs drained, McIntyre complained. Meanwhile, rural residents near the lake have been struggling with conservation mandates and skyrocketing water bills, while at the same time their property values have plunged, with no more lakefront views. And that's driving some residents to move away entirely. But it's not only rural residents who are concerned. A Los Angeles Times article last year cited a CAL FIRE official voicing concern over loss of water in lakes and ponds across Southern California. While some of that drying up was due to the drought, in this case, it all boils down to greed. The city of San Diego pays $800 per acre foot to buy Colorado River water, but only about $240 per acre foot for water that it acquires by draining Lake Morena, putting saving money ahead of saving lives. McIntyre charged, Lives have been lost that may possibly have been saved if they had been able to get water out of Lake Morena and not burned 6,000 acres in less than 12 hours. There are more problems. Without enough water in the lake to recharge groundwater supplies, some residents are concerned about concentrations of nitrates and minerals seeping into the aquifer, contaminating drinking water. And some wells are coming up completely dry. Wildlife is also being impacted at the lake site, a stopover for migratory birds along the flyway in better years, as well as a source of drinking water for many animal species. Supervisor Diane Jacob has tried for years now to get the city to stop draining Lake Morena, or at least leave the water at a reasonable level for firefighting. But the city has demanded about $2 million a year to do so, money the county says it can't afford. The county is also losing revenues, since it owns lands around the lake, including a park with campgrounds and cabins. And the impact has been devastating on local merchants who rely on tourism from fishermen, campers, hikers, and boaters. Income that is now dried up. McIntyre calls that situation outrageous. She concludes, "The city of San Diego needs to be held accountable. We need to stand up as a community and stand behind Diane Jacob and say, we're not going to take it anymore." Billy Jo Jannen, chair of the planning group, agreed that public safety is at risk, and she asked about a legal remedy. McIntyre explained how new laws aim to assure local control of groundwater supplies. She hopes an attorney willing to file suit against the city on a contingent fee basis can be found to help this low-income community. McIntyre explained that the county is bound by its contract with the city, but she advised, community members are not bound by that contract, adding, "We can take them on." And then she asked her neighbors present, "What price are you going to put on your life?" East County Magazine has submitted a Public Records Act request to CAL FIRE for all communication records during the border fire related to Lake Morena water levels, and we will announce those once received. We have also asked San Diego Mayor Kevin Faulkner, City Council members, and the city's Public Safety Committee to respond to the serious public safety concerns raised by lowering water levels in Lake Morena, a decision that has put communities across rural East County more at risk than ever of devastation during wildfires.
San Diego County Fire can now dispatch up to 4 new quick-attack vehicles to assist CAL FIRE when a brush fire breaks out in a hard-to-reach part of the backcountry. The vehicles, known as patrols, are smaller and faster than the larger engine, but are equipped with all the same basic life-saving equipment. They can hold up to 200 gallons of water and 10 gallons of gel or foam. The new fire patrol vehicles are assigned to county fire stations in Hakumba, Palomar Mountain, Duluth, and Shelter Valley. Many of these areas were burned during the destructive 2003 and 2007 wildfires. While the vehicles were generally built for wildfire response, they will also be used to respond to everyday calls for medical aid, traffic collisions, and structural fires. Patrol vehicles will be frontline, first-roll response units at volunteer or reserve stations and will supplement the current county fire fleet. CAL FIRE and County Fire Chief Tony Meacham says that for the rural backcountry, the patrol vehicles are more suitable than a fire engine. They are simple to operate, very quick and maneuverable, and allow our reserves to get to the scene quickly, he says. They are also used for mop-up, allowing fully staffed engines to be put back into service quickly. This type of patrol vehicle is new to County Fire's fleet. 5 were purchased last year and were used heavily, particularly when County Fire and CAL FIRE were assisting other counties as part of a mutual aid strike team. The patrols have 2 people on them at a time, and firefighters are required to take additional training on the operation of these vehicles. Each patrol, fully equipped, costs nearly $260,000. 2 of the new vehicles were funded by federal community development block grants for low and moderate income areas, and 2 were paid for by the county's general fund. County Housing and Community Development Director Todd Henderson concludes, "Strengthening our regional fire defense is a critical component of healthy, safe, and thriving communities, and one the county can be proud to stand behind." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
Effective immediately, the U.S. Forest Service has authorized its next-generation firefighting air tankers to operate at Brownfield in Otay Mesa near the border during times of elevated wildfire risk. Supervisor Diane Jacob calls the announcement a step forward but says it doesn't go far enough. She adds, Ramona Air Attack Base in the heart of wildfire country still makes the most sense. She notes the high risk of wildfire in our mountain areas, site of the devastating 2003 Cedar Fire and the 2007 firestorms. The decision will make it faster to reach communities scorched by the border fire, such as Potrero, Campo, and Lake Morena. However, response times from brownfield to mountain areas such as Ramona, Cuyamaca, and Julian will still be longer than if the tankers were based in Ramona. The change comes after Supervisor Jacob and other local officials repeatedly called on the Forest Service to allow its air tankers to take off and land at the Ramona Air Base. Those pleas were ignored. During the border fire in late June, Jacob sharply criticized the Forest Service for flying in tankers from San Bernardino to battle the blaze, contending that the long distance was too far when every second counted to stop a wildfire. The border fire killed two Potrero residents and destroyed five homes, as well as 11 outbuildings, charring 7,000 acres. The Forest Service has said that Ramona's airstrip is too short, but CAL FIRE is already landing similar large tanker planes there. Jeff Power, Regional Aviation Officer with the Forest Service, says the brownfield option is the best alternative to reduce risk to flight crews and the community. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
4 years ago, the San Miguel Consolidated Fire Protection District contracted out its firefighting services to CAL FIRE, but now the board has voted 4-3 to axe its agreement with CAL FIRE and return to being a standalone district. The decision came after a contentious meeting that lasted nearly 5 hours. The board moved to appoint an ad hoc committee to create a plan for ending the contract with CAL FIRE. The meeting room at the district's Spring Valley headquarters was packed. Some voiced appreciation for CAL FIRE, but most speakers, as well as most emails received from the public, argued that it's time to regain local control. At the time the 5-year contract was entered into, the district said it had a $1.7 million budget shortfall caused by the recession and falling property values, which had forced closure of a fire station on Dehesa Road. But now, Board President Teresa McKenna told the crowd, funding is available to go back to a standalone district. She said, if we do not get out of this contract now, we never will. It's now or never. McKenna was elected to the board in 2014 on a platform of returning the district to local control. She claimed that former Fire Chief August Gio steered the board with incorrect data that helped support contracting out with CAL FIRE. She provided the board with a report that showed the district has been losing over $100,000 a month through its contracted services with CAL FIRE, not saving money as promised. But Director William Keel argued that before the district decides to return to local control, it should conduct a more in-depth analysis by an independent consultant. A study done by the district's chief financial officer was insufficient, said Keel, who added that he doesn't think terminating the contract is in the public's best interest. Director Dave Rickards, a former firefighter, said the board was rushing an important decision without getting all the information it needs. He added, I see alarm bells, and I want to make sure if it's done, it should be done right. Most who spoke criticized CAL FIRE's management of its employees, complaining that the lengthy hours the state's firefighters must work are causing serious physical and mental health problems for many families. From an average of 56 hours a week when San Miguel was a standalone district, CAL FIRE demands that the firefighters work a 72-hour week. Captain Ron Quinlan said working 3 24-hour shifts in a row is taxing on anyone's mental and physical health, especially with sleep deprivation. Firefighter Corey Powell sent an email calling the schedule unsafe, adding, I have witnessed my engineer falling asleep at the wheel. Yet several emailers and speakers told the board they shouldn't rush to such a major decision without getting more info about changing back to local control, including a cost-benefit analysis. However, the board majority insisted that it made its intentions to return to standalone well-known for more than a year and was not rushing into anything. Director Mike Bacchio concluded, if anything was rushed through, it was the CAL FIRE contract. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
In a week when news of police shootings of black men in Louisiana and Minnesota has filled the airwaves, California is taking concrete steps to fight racial profiling with the first meeting of the new Racial and Identity Profiling Advisory Board in Los Angeles. The board was established by State Attorney General Kamala Harris through legislation passed last fall. The same bill also requires officers to record the perceived racial and identity profiles of every person they stop by 2018. Daniel Savor, chief of policy for the AG, says the board will decide how to make the best use of that data.
Infusing data and metrics into this conversation will bring about accountability and transparency, because we know how bias is destructive to trust and debilitating for a lot of communities of color.
Savor says the goal is to come up with training programs that can restore the relationship of trust between law enforcement agencies and the communities they serve. Daniel Szilard, who serves on the new board, is president of the Rosenberg Foundation, a nonprofit group that focuses on civil rights and criminal justice. He is hopeful about the board's potential to make improvements.
The diversity of folks represents a pretty powerful cross-section of law enforcement and academics and clergy and civil rights leaders and community leaders who would be advocating for sufficient resources behind this effort.
The board is tasked with drafting regulations on how the traffic stop data will be reported, and they will produce an annual report on California's progress in eliminating racial profiling. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Chisato Iverson, guest hosting Destination East County.
The 4th of July fireworks are over, but there are many more midsummer festivities coming up, including theatrical productions, Pine Valley Days, outdoor concerts, films, star parties, a sip of Julian, and our very own Roaring Twenties party. So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
Young Actors Theater invites you to step into the enchanted world of Broadway's modern classic, Disney's Beauty and the Beast. The theatrical production with live orchestra will be staged July 7th through 16th at the Joan B. Kroc Center on University Avenue in San Diego, just one block east of La Mesa. The classic story centers around Belle, a young woman in a provincial town, and the Beast, who is really a young prince trapped under the spell of an enchantress. If the Beast can learn to love and be loved, the curse will end, but the time is running out. For tickets and details, visit yatsandiego.org.
What could be more delightful on a summer's eve than to savor supper in a vineyard with an array of tantalizing menus and wines? Hatfield Creek Vineyards in Ramona is hosting summer suppers on the second Sunday each month at 4 p.m. with a limit of 20 guests. For reservations or details on this and other upcoming events, you can visit hatfieldcreekvineyards.com.
The City of La Mesa's Family Fun Sundays at 6 concert series will be held once again in Harry Griffin Park each Sunday evening from 6 to 7 p.m.,
The shortlist is back in Lemon Grove. Summer Film Night takes place each Wednesday evening now through July 27th at 6:30 p.m. in the Lemon Grove Library. Comedy, drama, animation, and documentary from the long-running PBS series The Shortlist, now a cult classic among viewers who relish great short films, will remind you that the world is large and never dull. The season is sponsored by the Lemon Grove Historical Society and the Lemon Grove Library and made possible by New Pacific Productions. The shortlist is geared to a general audience ages 18 and over.
Night fishing continues at Santee Lakes on Thursday evenings, July 21st, August 4th, and August 18th from 5 to 11:30 p.m. A lantern is required and no radios are allowed. Learn more at santeelakes.com.
Santee Lakes will also host Movies and More by the Lakes on July 15th at 6 p.m. with a showing of The Princess Bride, which is rated PG. Gates open at 4 p.m. There will be food trucks, a snack bar, and other fun activities, too. For more information, you can visit santeelakes.com.
Disney's The Lion King has captivated the imagination of audiences around the world, and now, for the first time ever, Christian Youth Theater San Diego has the opportunity to produce this one-of-a-kind musical on July 21st through 24th at the Helix Main Stage Theater in La Mesa. The African savanna comes to life on stage with Simba, Rafiki, and an unforgettable cast of characters as they journey from Pride Rock to the jungle and back again in this inspiring coming-of-age tale. For tickets, you can visit cytsandiego.org.
Pine Valley Days will take place July 29th and 30th in the mountain town of Pine Valley. A highlight of the two-day festival is a parade along Old Highway 80 through Pine Valley on July 29th, starting at 9 a.m., featuring horses, bagpipes, clowns, cars, dragons, marching bands, and more. Other activities include a craft village at the Pine Valley County Park on Saturday, Friday night deep pit barbecue and dancing in the park after dark, plus a burrito breakfast on Saturday and a music festival. For full details, you can visit pinevalleydays.com.
The Julian Chamber of Commerce is hosting the second annual Sip of Julian on Saturday, July 30th from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. The Sip features growers and producers of wine, craft beer, hard cider, and mead, an ancient honey-based beverage offering up samplings of their own handcrafted specialties. Samples will be paired with small bites at each venue, where you can also take in the scenery and spend a relaxing day enjoying the sights and sounds of Julian, a historic gold rush town. Proceeds will benefit Julian's annual Country Christmas and tree lighting celebration. For tickets and information, visit julianca.com and click on events.
East County Magazine invites you to our very own Roaring Twenties party on Sunday, July 31st from 4 to 7 p.m. Don your flapper, gangster, or 20s film style attire and join the festivities at the San Pasqual Winery Tasting Room in La Mesa. Entertainment includes singers and dancers from Visionary Dance Theater performing a preview of their upcoming production of Chicago, as well as 20s-era film showings and prizes. Get in the spirit of the ragtime and jazz age at our party of the century, complete with a catered Italian feast that Al Capone and the Great Gatsby would have loved, all to benefit our nonprofit public media outlet. For reservations and tickets, you can visit eastcountymagazine.org.
The Julian Star Fest is a free public star party in Julian that will take place August 6th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. You can take a star tour of the heavens using the many telescopes set up in the viewing area. Experts will be on hand to answer questions. Parking is available nearby, and it is suggested that you bring a red light flashlight to guide yourself to the observing area. If you don't have a red light flashlight, red film will be provided to cover a white light flashlight. Please, no white lights in the observing area. Find out more at julianstarfest.com.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org. If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back again next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Today we are going to be talking about the proposed sand mine in Lakeside's El Monte Valley, and my very special guest today is Anna Nita. Anna is a Lakeside resident. She is also a journalist and an activist, and she has been working on a documentary about this entire issue. Anna, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me a little bit about yourself first. How long have you lived in Lakeside, and what drew you to that area?
I lived in Lakeside for the past 8 years, and I am happy to be a resident of this amazing community. I learned so much, and my favorite attraction is the closeness to the hiking trails, because that's my favorite thing to do with my daughter.
How will those hiking trails be impacted if this proposed sand mine were to be approved?
For people who do not know what are we talking about and who never visited El Monte Valley, it's the last pristine wildlife habitat in the entire San Diego County, not just in East County. Two roads flanking the valley are designated scenic roads, not the valley itself. So Willow Road and El Monte Road are scenic roads.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the types of wildlife that that you see out there?
Well, first of all, we have like few endangered species that are federally protected, and I think they should remain that way. And I can name the glossy snake, the checker spot butterfly, the gnatcatcher, least bell vireos, and recently there was, I think, three-legged red frog discovered, which is very rare.
Mm.
And but you can see tons of other creatures living in the valley, such as several species of hawks,
mm-hmm.
Bald eagles, you see them there, golden eagles.
Bald eagles are very rare in our county.
That's true.
Also, I know folks who've seen bobcats, weasels, all kinds of things, mountain lions out there even.
That's true. Fox?
Fox, yeah, lots of them. So for people who are not familiar with the Sand Mine Project, can you tell us how large that would be? Put it in perspective for us.
They wanted to start on the land they optioned right now, which is a few hundred acres, but I do have information that they want to ultimately sand mine the entire valley if they can actually purchase more
and how
land.
Deep would the mining go?
The initial plan asked for 100 feet deep,
mm-hmm.
But right now they revised the project and they claim only 35 feet deep. That's only 5 feet above the water, the aquifer.
Yeah, so people I know are very concerned about the water quality, the folks that are on wells out there. And even if they scale it back, there still are some very significant impacts. For example, we've heard that the gravel trucks, according to the EIR, or the plans that the developer put forward, would be going down this road every few seconds all day long for 20 years or 30 years. I guess it was initially 30, and now they're saying 20 years. But still, every day, 5 days a week, the residents would be subjected to this. And many of them are very, very, very close to the road where these trucks would be going by virtually nonstop. Now, I understand there are also some concerns about valley fever. Can you tell us about that?
I interviewed several people who got infested by valley fever, which is a fungus you can find around the Native Americans' sites, and especially around Indian Village.
Yeah, and this was the original home of a Kumeyaay village down there. This was a place where Native Americans lived for thousands of years.
And you're lucky if you survive valley fever, because I just recently met a gentleman who is actually dying from it.
Yeah,
it's very dangerous.
It can be fatal. Valley fever spores are not harmful if they stay buried, but the problem occurs if they are disrupted, if the soil is exposed. And obviously, when you sand mine, this can expose a tremendous amount of spores. I might add, not only in El Monte Valley, but to anywhere else where that sand is carried and transmitted. So if it's used for construction projects elsewhere in the county, potentially it could spread those spores. At least that's what a valley fever expert has told us in the past. So, Anna, tell us about your documentary.
Well, I started hiking in the valley several years ago, and my best friend, Billy Ortiz, told me about the story of sand mining. And
yeah, Billy Ortiz, he used to write quite a bit for us, and now he's out doing a lot of his own reporting and about this all over various sites that he has on Facebook.
He and I are the leader of this movement. We are leading Preserve Our El Monte page and also the community in the fight against sand mining. So hiking in the valley like several years ago with my best friend Billy Ortiz, I found out about the story of sand mining, and my first reaction was to scream, I think this is not a story about business against nature. This is a story about corruption. I can securely say that based on my experience as an investigative reporter covering hundreds of stories in my life, and most of them similar. So after I found out about that, I wanted to do a documentary, which I'm still working on, but I faced the same dilemma that every reporter faces sometimes. There was a story a few years ago about somebody who set himself on fire, and the camera guy was recording and didn't jump in to save the person.
Yeah.
So I faced the same dilemma. What do I do? Do I report or do I get involved?
And how do you resolve that?
I'm reporting it in an objective manner, trying to stay neutral and seek the truth. And in the same time, I got involved because the truth is the truth.
Yeah.
And I know the truth. And as a citizen, I choose to get involved. And as a journalist, I choose to report on it.
So we're going to go into some more details in a moment. But first, can you tell our listeners a little bit about your background as an investigative reporter? Where did you work? Where were your stories published or aired?
Right now, I'm a freelancer journalist, so I published in East County, California,
mm-hmm.
and several other avenues. I work for the news, inside.com, which is a news agency, and also as a news editor for NBC7. But in the past, I was a war correspondent. I travel, and my causes of choice are disadvantaged children and women.
Wow.
So I've been awarded by UNICEF for my and Save the Children for my contribution to the cause of children.
So with NBC and working as a war correspondent, obviously you have some very extensive journalist credentials, and you know the journalism code of ethics and so forth, and you have experience writing about and uncovering corruption stories, which brings us to the issue of Michael Beck. Michael Beck is the chairman of the San Diego County Planning Commission, and he was appointed by Supervisor Diane Jacob. He's also the chairman of the San Diego River Park Foundation, and he also is
the president of Endangered Habitat League, who is partnered up with the sand miners.
Okay, so he's president of the Endangered Habitat League. They're partnering with the sand mine owners, and so they stand to profit directly and in a very large way, presumably, if the sand mine is built. So you have gone to the supervisors and publicly called for Michael Beck to resign. What did he say?
Well, I went to the San Diego County Board of Supervisors, and then I went to the San Diego Planning Commission. So when I went to the San Diego County Board of Supervisors, I asked all the five supervisors to step in and solve the issues, try to, make the right decision when it comes to Hanson Pond, which is a replica on a smaller scale of what Michael Beck intends to do in a valley. And also I asked for Michael Beck's resignation and several other things. But
yeah, I understand. You also asked that if he didn't resign, you've asked the supervisors to remove him. It would be Supervisor Jacob who appointed him to remove him. And what answer have you had to that? So has she agreed to remove him or consider removing him or not?
I'm still waiting for an official answer.
Okay. And you've mentioned that it's been quite a while now and that she may feel some loyalties to Michael Beck, who in some ways at one time was considered an environmentalist, but also I understand there's some direct ties with him and the supervisor. Can you tell us about that?
Well, one thing I found out, and I can prove it, is that Michael Beck organized fundraising campaign for another supervisor. His name is Dave Roberts. And when I inquired Supervisor Roberts about that, I've been banned, and I still don't have an official answer.
So he banned you on his Facebook page?
He did, yes, but I don't have an official answer to my email either.
You know, that's an interesting point, because when Sheriff Bill Gore tried to ban people on his Facebook page who posted things he didn't like, there was a decision, a ruling that came out that said that that's illegal, that you cannot do that. If a public official has a website, they cannot ban posts, I mean, unless it's obscene or something like that. And so he actually opted and told that he had to either allow all the posts or take the site down. He took his Facebook page down. So that's interesting. I'm not sure that Supervisor Roberts is on legal ground there to ban posters off of his official supervisor Facebook page. I suspect that he is not. Well, that's not the first time that Supervisor Robert has had, you know, lobbyists and development project supporters hold fundraisers for him. In fact, it was done immediately within a week after he voted to approve the Soitec Solar, very controversial industrial-scale solar project out in the Boulevard McCain Valley area. And the lobbyist for the landowner in the Soitec project promptly hosted a big fundraiser for Roberts, which upset a lot of people at the time. They felt that he should have recused himself because that seemed to be a rather clear conflict of interest if you're voting on something knowing you've got a fundraiser coming up being held by the project's lobbyist.
We, Billy Ortiz and I, as the leader of this movement, are not on a personal vendetta against Diane Jacobs or Dave Roberts or any other supervisor of Michael Beck.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we do not deny they did amazing things for the community, but it does not excuse them, of the fact that they're not doing the right thing right now. Supervisor
right.
Jacob does have the power to ask Michael Beck to resign because she's the one who appointed him as the member of the San Diego Planning Commission, and she's the one who has the power to ask him to resign.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of points here. We should note that Diane Jacob was the only one of the supervisors in the past who fought and tried to get the PUC to block the Sunrise Power Link that was very controversial through the same valley out there in Lakeside. So there's certainly some reason why some folks in Lakeside feel some loyalties to her, and she's not here to, you know, to discuss this today. We certainly welcome her comments on the situation currently. But back to Michael Beck for a moment. So there's more, though, than just this perceived conflict of interest. Potentially, I suppose he could recuse himself from the vote. But you've also raised concerns about his activities at Hanson Pond, which is an old sand mining project in Lakeside. As I understand it, his environmental organization, you know, had taken county funding with a promise to restore the habitat out there. How's that coming along?
Well, that's not coming along very well. And when we try to step in and inquire what is going on, Supervisor Jacob threatened us with the sheriff's to call the police on us. Yes.
She threatened to call the sheriff on you. And what were you doing at the time? What was it that you were trying to do?
Well, first of all, we were the first ones to raise awareness about the fact that although Michael Beck Organization and Danger Habitat League received public money to purchase the land at Hanson Pond to restore it and then to build a trail, a public trail, multi-use public trail, and also a staging area, he closed down the public trail and refuses, you know, to cooperate.
Now, she has said that this was on private land.
Well, it was partially on private land, but San Diego County paid him $1 million for just the rights to build the trail on 33 acres.
And then he closed the trail down. And coincidentally, right about the time that a protest was planned at the pond over this project.
That's true. So San Diego County does have the power to hold him accountable for his side of the bargain. And so when I found out that Dan Jacobs is going to have a private secret meeting with Michael Beck and Robin Reardon, who is the executive director of Lakeside River Park Conservancy and the one who received the grant to restore Hanson Pond, Billy Ortiz and I went to her public office, were invited to sit in a waiting room. And 1 minute after, her assistant, Adam Wilson, came outside and said that we want to play games, and if we don't leave right away, Dan Jacob is going to call the police on us.
Her aide threatened to call the sheriff?
He actually said, Dan Jacob says so. I asked him...
Was this in a public building?
Right after, we called her office in San Diego and asked if her office in El Cajon is private or public, and we've been told it's a public office. A private office is only when she pays for the rent.
Correct.
With
it
her own money.
It is a public office.
It's a public office, and we've been threatened with the police if we don't leave the premises where we were actually invited in.
Who invited you?
Adam Wilson, the same person.
Wow.
Who told us.
We'll certainly be reaching out to Supervisor Jacob to ask her about that. This is the first that I'm hearing about this threatened arrest, but we definitely would like to hear why they did that, why they did not want you in the meeting, the private meeting that she was having with Michael Beck.
I mean, I understood that I cannot be in a meeting because it was a private meeting, that I understood, but I requested, can we just sit and wait, and maybe we can have a word after that, you know, we can have a statement after mm-hmm. that. And Adam Wilson said, sure, sit down. And then he just came outside and said, no, Dan Jacob said that you have to leave, otherwise she's going to call her.
So you left?
Yes, we left, yes, of course. And we waited outside on the stairs, and we tried to get a statement from Michael Beck, and I tried many times to get his point of view on these, mm-hmm. and he didn't. So
well, I should add that we have reached out to Michael Beck previously in an email asking for his side of the story on some of these issues with the sand mine, and he has just ignored us and has not gotten back to us either. So it's very troubling, I think, when somebody who is a public official, he is a planning commissioner for the county. And when a planning commissioner has such an obvious conflict of interest, he would profit off this project. He has not said he'd recuse himself. And now he's in private meetings where the press, you know, or a citizen activist, either one, is threatened with, you know, being thrown out of the premises for simply wanting to wait and try to ask a question afterwards. I think that's very, very troubling.
His attitude was similar when I went to the San Diego County Planning Commission and I asked him directly to resign, and I reminded him that he owes an answer to the public.
Yeah.
He is a public official and he does owe an answer to the public.
Have you reached out to the Fair Political Practices Commission, which, after all, recently informed Supervisor Bill Horn that he would have to recuse himself from the Lydic Hills, you know, big development vote, where he had said he wasn't going to recuse himself, even though he had a direct potential financial gain from his own property if the project was approved, since he lives nearby. And they said, yes, he must recuse himself.
I did. About half a year ago, I never heard from them, and I kept sending emails to all the agency who actually financed the project mm-hmm. at Hanson Pond and all the organizations that have Michael Beck on their board, because, you know, you cannot promote yourself as being an environmentalist. Yeah.
But how about the State Fair Political Practices Commission, which oversees these conflicts of interest?
I reached out to them with an email as well.
And they have not answered?
I haven't received any answer.
So what happens next with this project? We understand that, you know, the developer came back. They've scaled it back a little bit. It's still a massive project, but now it's 20 years instead of 30. So does that mean that there's a new environmental impact report that has to be done next?
No, they are working on the environmental impact report, and I understand it's going to be done by, you know, the end of this summer. Mm-hmm. So after that, the public will have a window of, I think, 30 days or 60 days to comment on.
So probably late summer, early fall, the public will have a window again for comment. So you can keep checking on eastcountymagazine.org and in our Green Scene section and our Lakeside Santee section, and we'll be posting updates on that. If the project is approved by the county, or if Michael Beck does not recuse himself here and the project is approved, how far are the residents of Lakeside and El Monte Valley prepared to go to stop this?
As far as it takes, because what is right is right and what is wrong is wrong. There are gray areas in politics, but we don't care about politics and politicians and their games. We don't want to let that happen in El Monte Valley. It's not the right thing to do. You cannot just kill and destroy wildlife habitat for profit. So we are willing to, we are actually prepared to sue them.
So you're prepared to file a lawsuit against the county and everybody else involved?
Yes, we are.
Wow. Well, we will definitely be keeping everyone posted on that. Anna, if people want to get more information about this, can you tell us the websites or the Facebook pages of your organizations where people can learn more and if they want to get involved to do that?
Certainly, and thank you for giving me that option. Our Facebook page is Preserve Our El Monte, which shortens in POEM.
Mm-hmm.
Easy to remember. We also have a website. It's called Save El Monte Valley. And for people who want to get involved as volunteers, we have a Facebook group, which is called Friends of the El Monte Valley.
And okay, so Friends of El Monte Valley on Facebook. Preserve El Monte, is that also a Facebook page?
Yes, Preserve Our El Monte is the page where we post updates and articles and videos about our fight. And,
okay,
and the group is just for people who want to get directly involved, such as giving out flyers and...
And the third one again was?
It's just the website where we post information, Save Our El Monte.
So if you go to Preserve Our El Monte on Facebook, there's a link there for the...
For the group and also for the website and the group of volunteers for everybody who wants to get involved and do something.
Anna, I'm going to give you the final word here today. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know that I have not specifically asked you about today?
Sure, I would like to give credit to Billy Ortiz. He is the other leader of the movement, and without him, you know, I wouldn't have, you know, ever heard of the story, and I wouldn't have never discovered what a treasure El Monte Valley is. But I also want to give credit to our community, and it's my firm belief that no matter what goes on behind the closed door, the community has the real power to change the story, and one person can make a difference. I am a firm believer in the power of the people. I urge everybody to get involved and spread the word, because the fight is not over and it will never be over as long as we're going to keep fighting.
Okay. I want to thank you so very much, Anna, for taking time to come out and join us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you for having me.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
This is Mark Clements.
And this is Cody Clements.
Working hard to bring you the wildest jobs in East County. Today, Cody and I went to Lakeside. There we met a man who's going to explain why his workday is more interesting than yours, or at least more likely to end up in a trip, to the hospital. I'm here today with Kevin Higley, who is a rodeo clown. Kevin, how long have you been doing rodeo clowning?
Ooh, that's a dated question, huh? You're going to make me tell how old I am is what you're trying to get at, right? No, I've been actually a professional rodeo clown for 30 years. Prior to that, I participated in high school rodeo. and as a contestant, and then I started doing what we call amateur rodeos as a rodeo clown bullfighter, and then I got my pro card and went on to the professional ranks, and so I've been it for, I bet you, total almost 35 years.
So you were doing professional rodeo as what prior to doing the clown part of it?
I was I tried to be a bull rider. Thought maybe I could make a profession out of it and a living. Wasn't very good at that. So what it came to be was my brother was a really good bull rider, and we had what they call a practice pen at home where we buck some bulls and stuff. And so we took turns being the bullfighter who would save the bull rider. Well, boy, I saved him a whole lot more than he ever thought of saving me. And so it became apparent that I was probably a little bit more adapted to the bullfighting area and saving the cowboys. And that was really the love and passion that I had once I got started, that, you know, the thrill of saving a guy so you can get on to another one is really something else. And as time went on, of course, you slow down a couple steps. Not me, but my mind may. I don't know. But anyway, so then I transferred into the rodeo clown / barrel man type aspect of the professional rodeo deal.
Now, you use the term bull fighting, which seems more appropriate to me somehow. So here's another question for you. I've noticed that bulls don't seem to have a lot of sense of humor. So have you actually made one ever laugh?
Oh, yeah, they're always smiling when they run over you. Yeah, well, they've got a smile. You know, a lot of people, they used to say that a bull will actually close his eyes before he runs over you. But that's not true. I can attest to that. They're wide open, and they are laughing. It's like, I got you, buddy. It's good.
So the natural follow-up to that is, how many bones have you had broken?
That's one we don't like to discuss very much. But, you know, I've been really fortunate in my career to stay away from most of the broken bones. I fractured a couple neck vertebrae, and I've had a couple of bones in my foot broke and a couple things like that. But as a whole, I've been really healthy and really good.
Do you really like to use the word whole when you're talking about bulls and horns and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's kind of, you got to watch that one. Put you in a hole.
Now, I'm sure that people, not necessarily associated with rodeo, but people on the outside probably think that you would do this for the thrills. What kind of satisfaction do you get from actually doing this work?
That's a great question. You know, like I said early on, it is just the satisfaction that you've did something to help somebody else to be able to further their career and go on and stuff. So saving a bull rider from a bull, or helping him, assisting him to be a higher score, that's where it starts. And that now it's the thrill of entertainment, you know, making people laugh. I just love to hear them giggle and laugh. And so that part is where I'm at now in my career. So we do it for the love, because, you know, unlike a lot of professional sports, the money isn't probably as good as your football, your baseball, your basketball players, but it also is an aspect of it. We do it for the money as well.
Yeah, so you're as a professional rodeo, I see that you have a big trailer, so you travel around from rodeo to rodeo?
I do. Throughout the course of this year, I'll probably be in at least 15 states. I guess the farthest away, which my trailer wasn't able to go with me and a lot of my animals wasn't, was Hawaii. We've actually did rodeos in Hawaii on two of the islands over there.
Oh, really? So you did go to Hawaii, but you just didn't float your trailer across?
No, trailer stayed home as well as my animals that I use in my clown acts, yeah.
Okay, so you do an act out on the in the arena with your own animals. I see you have a dog over there. Is that one of your?
Yeah, I've actually got three or four dogs, and I've got a trick horse, trick mule. You know, sometimes the kids become my tricks. You know, I'm very enthusiastic about getting the crowd involved, and so we use the kids a lot of times in some of the things we do.
If I ever were to find myself in a field with a pissed off bull, because, you know, that happens to me a lot, give me some ideas for how to sort of distract the guy.
Well, you know, so the best thing to do is, of course, it's not all about how fast you can outrun them. It's about the move that you can make to get around them. because they got a big old body and they got to bend in half to get to back to where you are. So what you want to do is you want to kind of get in as close as possible and then make that move to the inside and keep them coming. And then when you get the break, you break them so they're on a different lead and you can get away from them.
So you have to fight every instinct, natural instinct, to turn around and run. You have to get close to them, right next to them, in order to be safe.
You're sure better off. Yeah, you're better off. I mean, I know that my legs have never stood around for my face to take a beating, you know. And so it's kind of a natural instinct to run, yes. But, you know, there's a lot of different things you use. The apparel that we wear, the things we wear that gets their attention, that will bring them in your direction, and then it's up to you to make the move to bring them away from the cowboy and to get yourself away.
Okay. Now, professional football players, you mentioned them. They're always complaining about having a short career. Now, you've been doing this for a while. How long would you say the average rodeo clown sort of stays in the profession?
You know, and I guess that would be a term that's kind of tough to use, average, because I don't know any of us that are too, you know. And I guess the guy that kind of I look up to and kind of was my mentor, taught me a little bit, was a guy by the name of Wick Path. And he actually fought bulls at an active level, professional level, till he was 57 years old. It's all about how physically fit you stay. We've got a guy in the business right now that's strictly entertainment. He doesn't even get in the barrel anymore or do any of those things to help out. And he's 78 years old and very active and doing a great job.
Okay, well, see, my son here is, let's say that he goes to see his guidance counselor at school, and the guidance counselor, I've noticed, doesn't have any posters on the wall of rodeos or anything.
No.
But let's say that she says that she's changed her mind and he should forget about engineering and all of that, and he should become a rodeo clown. What advice would you give him for getting into this job, apart from why don't you do something safe like join the Navy SEALs?
Yeah, there we go. Two safe jobs. Well, I'll tell you what the first thing I would do with modern day rodeo, we have schools, and the best thing to do for someone that's inspiring to be a rodeo clown or a bullfighter or a participant, a contestant, is to search out one of those schools and go spend a week, 3 days, whatever the school is, and actually get a head start on what they really could do and if they're adapted for that.
Do you know of any women who do this job who are rodeo clowns?
You know, there used to be, years ago, there was a lady that actually didn't actually do the bullfighting part of the clown, but she got in the barrel, and she would tell a few jokes and do stuff. But that was a long time ago. Right at this present time, I don't know anybody, any ladies. I think it has to do with intelligence.
Oh, okay. That's an excellent point. Cody, you have a question?
Yeah, what's the deal with the barrels? What exactly do you do with barrels?
Okay, the barrel is out there for a particular reason. We had put it out in the middle of the arena. Actually, not quite the middle of the arena. It's a little closer to the bucking chutes. And it really becomes kind of like a safe haven for the bullfighters or the bull riders. In case that bull is coming at them, they're caught out in no man's land. They can come there, catch their breath, get away, or at least the bull will be distracted so they can move on. It's my job as a barrel man to position my barrel in a place which will help assist the bullfighters and the bull rider to be able to have a little bit more safety. So, and it's really like sitting in a washing machine just waiting for somebody to turn that thing on, the spin cycle. Because when one of those guys hits it, it can really turn your world upside down.
So it sounds like your job is more about strategy than it is about, I mean, obviously on YouTube or on TV, what they like to show is rodeo clowns being tossed and trampled and all that. But the object is to avoid that and to protect the cowboys and to entertain the crowd, basically, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a given that you're going to be in a very bad situation most of the time, because, you know, you've got an unpredictable animal. He's gonna do what he wants to do. He's gonna do this. So you're gonna be put in a position where you're gonna get in there that you're probably gonna get what they call hooked and thrown out of there. But the better that you prepare yourself to be able to make yourself in the right position to walk away from that, the longer your career will be.
So you're kind of like the ninjas of the West, is what you're telling me.
I've never had it put that way, but yeah, cowabunga, dude, let's do it.
Okay, Cody.
So is it true about bulls that they don't like red capes? Is that true?
great question. You know, and it really is a myth. It doesn't have to do with the red cape that the matadors, you see if the matadors are fighting, or like in our case, we wear bandanas a lot of times on our deals. It's all about the movement. It's the movement of something that brings their attention to it. And that's why when you see the guys with the capes and the matadors, and they can stand in one spot, but the bull will follow the cape and follow that deal.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to the people of East County?
Boy golly, if they get a chance, come to the rodeo. They're going to enjoy it.
So, Cody, now that you've seen a little bit of what life as a rodeo clown is like, are you ready to reconsider your future?
No, because as much as my counselors say that I should quit any field that involves thinking, I think I should steer clear of this kind of career.
Are you saying that you don't want to get involved in something that can cow you this much?
You know, I have a lot of beef with you saying something that mean about me, Dad.
Well, I would say that right now my attitude is the lasso your problems.
I just don't know if I'm capable of learning the ropes on this exciting career.
Well, son, that sounds like a lot of bull to me, because I don't know anyone who clowns around as much as you do. This is Mark Clements.
And this is Cody Clements.
Clocking out of one of the wildest jobs in East County.
This is Kerry Hyatt reporting for the East County Magazine and KNSJ. Summertime is here, and the county's Department of Animal Services wants to remind everyone that these hot days can pose a danger to your pets. Animals can be very sensitive to high heat, said Don Danielson, Director of Animal Services. Here are some tips to keep your pet safe and comfortable during hot weather. Be sure your pet has shade all day. Remember, the sun's position changes during the day. Keep your pets indoors if the temperature is lower inside. Keep your pet's water supply in a tip-proof container, always topped off, and be sure it is cool. Pets will not drink water that is too hot. Consider a misting system to keep the outdoor areas cooler. A car can heat up very quickly on an 85-degree day. A car can reach 102 degrees in 10 minutes and soar upward to 120 degrees, even with the windows down an inch or two. So never leave your pet unattended in the car. If you exercise with your dog, do so only in the very early morning when the temperature is lower. Don't take dogs on extreme hikes in the heat, since many dogs have perished in hot weather on local trails. Don't take your dogs for walks on the hot pavement. If it is too hot for you to walk barefoot, then don't make your dogs do it either, since this can burn the pads of their feet. Consider adding a child's wading pool for your dog. Many dogs will keep cool by taking a dip. Following these tips can keep your pet safe and healthy. If you see a pet that is in immediate threat of death or injury, call the department's emergency number at 619-236-2341. For non-emergencies, call 619-767-2675.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.